Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke, the producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president, CEO, and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing some important news items from that week. On Monday, April 15th, Alan and Joe were joined by UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, former NY19 congressperson and attorney John Faso, and political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Sunday credited the Biden administration's policies for what he said was a significant drop in attempts by migrants to enter the U.S. illegally immediately after the expiration of a pandemic-era policy meant to deter those crossings. Mayorkas made that defense and also called on Congress to pass a comprehensive immigration overhaul while appearing on several talk shows Sunday. Republican officials on Sunday said the border needed to be secured before immigration laws could be changed. Early last week, border crossings hit their highest levels ever, topping 10,000 unlawful crossings per day, according to Customs and Border Projection data. Those numbers dropped off to about 6,300 on Friday, 4,200 on Saturday, the days after the Trump-era policy referred to as Title 42 ended at midnight on Thursday. Mayorkas said on CNN's State of the Union, saying that we are in day three, noting that those figures were a 50% drop from earlier in the week, saying, quote, "But you know, we've been planning for this transition for months and months, and we've been executing on our plan, and we will continue to do so." Libby.
I think that this is a broken immigration system. What Trump did, ripping children from the arms of parents, you know, was a horrible thing. This has got to be fixed in a way that will keep the borders secure, but also give people who are fleeing despots and violence and women who are fleeing sexual violence, that's for sure, and sex trafficking, an ability to come into our country and to seek asylum, get the green cards, become citizens, and work. You know, we talked before about Social Security. Well, you know, when folks are working, more people will be paying into mm-hmm. Social Security. And there are companies locally and across the country, given what's happened with people not working because of COVID and jobs not being filled, there's a new collection of people here that want to work and want to provide for their families. And we're not talking about getting people into being doctors. We're talking about, you know, hospitality, home health aides, work that needs to be done where we find a dearth of ability of hiring people, and then people just aren't being served the way they should in lots of different places. And I just wanted to say that on Sunday, Capital Women, this is why I wanted to talk about this, Capital Women is debuting its speaker series, and our first thing in our speaker series, the first event, thank you, is Immigration, a Human Crisis, and that's on Sunday on May 21st at 4 p.m. at the Women's Club on 725 Madison Avenue. And we have Mayor Sheehan's going to be speaking, Lauren DeRozier, who works with Sarah Rogerson at the Immigrant Law Center, Sherry Lasher from RISE, and Angela Castrillo-Vilchez, who is works for the Immigration Coalition of New York. I mean, there are people who are clamoring to come into this country because of the promise of the American dream. There are people in this country who can't get to that American dream because of the way the system is rigged against us. But these folks still want to come here and make a new life for their families. They are not criminals. They are not going to kill people. They're not going to increase the amount of crime. I saw a bunch of statistics yesterday that showed, you know, white male citizens of the United States are the ones who are really doing those crimes. But we blow it out of proportion when there's a crime committed by an illegal immigrant, and then we herald those who kill other people, as we've seen with Kyle Rittenhouse and Daniel Perry. So it's time for us to do something proactive here. And I've been hearing since I was a kid, because I had a cousin who worked for the INS, that's what it was called back then, Immigration and Naturalization Services, that, you know, things needed to be fixed. And that was in the 60s. And so we just, this is a can we can no longer afford to kick down the road.
Jennifer.
Yeah. I think for me, when I think about immigration, is that we really need to... My concern, I guess I should say, is not about the crime of new migrants who come in, or, you know, the possibility, that kind of threat. It's really about making sure that they are safe on the streets in America, because they do have targets on their backs, you know, by people who see them as a threat because of the conversations, because of the words used, because of the scapegoating and whistleblowing. But also, you know, I fear for many that we have to be careful about the kind of work we put blinders on and envision them in, right? Like the work that Americans who are here, citizens, don't want to do, because it is some of the lowest paying, and they get pigeonholed into it, and then they get caught in the economic traps, that kind of cycle of already dealing with a language barrier, maybe not being able to advocate for themselves or protect themselves, their children trying to go to schools or getting their children in schools where English may be a second language, and then being forced into, say, agricultural work or even hospitality, where the pay makes it really difficult for them to afford, have affordable housing and things like that. So I tend to look at this as more of a humanitarian, human-to-human view, though I know the policy is very important and we need to make sure we secure our border and we need to know who's in the United States, right? But I do think that there are better ways not to see them as other. And I don't know, I can't understand as I'm following it, how the administration is fully making this better. I don't, and I'm not.
So when you say, that's all right. So when you say other ways, you want to explicate?
Well, you know, so I understand, you know, the, what is it, CPA1, where they have to have a phone and then they, you know, sign up. And so they have an asylum meeting, right, on the app. Okay. So, yeah, there's going to be problems with that. People won't have service. They won't have an app, you know. But then, like, the idea that you will do this and you'll set up your meeting, but that means you have to enter at the time. You have to have this set up. But also some of the meetings are a decade away. Right? Like, that's part of what the problem is. It's not just the number of people. It's that the system doesn't have enough judges. They do not have enough people to then accommodate this app we have set up for people to have their meetings. I mean, where do you stay for a decade while you're waiting for your meeting to happen with your children? What do your children do? Right? Like, for that 5-10 years until your asylum hearing happens. So those are the kind of things I know the administration is saying and they're working on. I'm just confused a little bit of how that's actually addressing quickly the issue that we're dealing with.
John Passo.
Well, clearly this is a longstanding problem. It's vexed multiple administrations. I think the Biden administration made some mistakes early on in terms of simply reversing everything that the prior administration had done or attempting to. Sometimes they were thwarted by legal action. The vast majority of these folks coming in are not coming because of political repression. They're coming for economic opportunity, the vast majority of them. And what has frequently happened is people who are actually economic migrants are claiming asylum for political reasons, and the vast majority of those claims are not accurate, they're false. What's happened in recent years is that we've seen increasing numbers of people, because the system gets overwhelmed, come into the country, claim asylum, and then they are released into the country for that, as Jennifer said, multiple years waiting for an asylum hearing. So a couple of things that I think have to be done. One, when you hear Secretary Mayorkas and the administration say we need a quote-unquote comprehensive immigration solution, that can't pass. It's not going to pass in the Congress. What they should be doing, in my view, is looking to incrementally fix some of these problems, like the lack of administrative law judges to handle these cases. The policy the Biden administration is now putting into place, apparently, says you cannot claim asylum if you come across the Rio Grande. You must go through a port of entry and claim asylum. That, to me, makes a lot of sense. And I think overall, there has to be, we should be looking at changing our system so that we can bring in people who want to work. And many of those people want to go back. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that with the H-1 visas, where agricultural and hospitality industries could not survive in this country mm-hmm. without those workers. And the vast majority of those folks have no intention of staying
that's
here.
Right.
They want to come in and go home. And that's critical that we expand those numbers. So we should be expanding the number of people who want to come in and work, who want to go back under these work visas. We should not let people who are coming for economic reasons claim political repression and to get an asylum. And we should also look at enticing people who have skills that would be good for our country in whatever field we're talking about, but have more of a skills-based system that brings people into the country, as opposed to, say, a family unification where one person comes in and then they can petition to get other members of their family coming in. That may be not the best thing for the United States, but this issue of immigration has been one that has gone through over 100 years. We've had these waves where immigrants come in and then the anti-Japanese and anti-Chinese laws are enacted. Mm-hmm. You saw that in California mm-hmm. back at the turn of the century.
Yep.
And then you had the waves of Italian and Irish immigrants come in mm-hmm. and, you know, no Italians or Irish need apply kind of signs that people would see. So there's always been resentment. And usually it's resentment of people who are going to be the economic competitors with the new arrivals. That's where a lot of that resentment springs forth. So it's complicated. I think, though, the administration, I'll sum it up, they should not be looking to have a comprehensive solution, because it's not attainable politically in Congress for multiple reasons. We should be looking at incremental changes that could begin take steps to solve this problem.
And some of those incremental changes, John, would be?
Well, for instance, what the administration is just now talking about, it should be codified in law that you cannot claim asylum if you come over the border illegally. You can only claim it, should only be able to claim asylum if you're coming through a recognized port of entry in the United States. We should have a more skills-based immigration system to bring people who have skills that are needed in our economy, but we should also greatly expand the number of people who can come into the country who want to work with work visas and then go back home after their, you know, 6 months or whatever period it is. And we should expand the number of administrative law judges who can handle and hear the asylum claims that are out there. And many of those are valid, but my understanding is the vast majority are not, because they're truly more economic claims rather than political repression claims.
So that's not being done because?
Because it's not being done, and I saw this firsthand when I was in Congress. It's not being done because the extremes on both sides want an all-or-nothing approach. If you don't give them everything they want, whether it's anti-immigration people or whether they're the open borders people, if you don't give them everything they want, they won't support these incremental changes. And that's, I think, politically, it's not going to happen. There may be some movement. I know that Senator Tillis from North Carolina and a couple of the Democratic senators and Senator Cornyn from Texas, they are part of a group that's trying to bring about some common sense incremental change. And I think the administration would be well advised to get off this notion that they have to solve every issue, because they're not going to get that passed. I'd rather have 40% of the loaf or 50% of the loaf rather than demanding 100% and then getting nothing.
Yeah, and we're so focused on the southern border. I mean, migrants are coming in not just from the Caribbean area or from South America, but when we're looking at people coming from, say, the African continent, where they're fleeing different things, or from the Middle East, right? We're still having issues mm-hmm. with Afghan asylum seeking and people that we had contact with for 20 years, right? So I think we have to look not just south at what's happening there, either fleeing crime or economics, or but also at the larger globe and how people are fleeing wars in other places, right? Even from Ukraine, right? People are coming to the United States to get out of that situation.
And China.
Yeah, and China. So it is more complicated, and I think having just the blinders on to only focus on the southern border is also making it hard to have comprehensive policies that are going to be effective.
Jennifer Burns on the Roundtable panel on Monday, May 15th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel The Week in Review. On Tuesday, May 16th, Alan Shartok and Joe Donahue were joined by investigative journalist and RPI and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, research professor and Stuart Rice honorary chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, Fran Berman, Tetherless World Chair of Computer Web and Cognitive Sciences and Founding Director of the Future of Computing Institute at RPI, Jim Hendler, and former Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
John Durham, the Trump-era special counsel who, for 4 years, has pursued a politically fraught investigation into the Russia inquiry, accused the FBI of having, quote, discounted or willfully ignored material information, unquote, that countered the narrative of collusion between Donald Trump and Russia in a final report made public yesterday. It is a 306-page report. It revealed little substantial new information about the inquiry known as Crossfire Hurricane. And it failed to produce the kinds of blockbuster revelations accusing the Bureau of politically motivated misconduct that former President Donald Trump and his allies suggested Mr. Durham would uncover. Instead, the report, released without substantive comment or any redactions by Attorney General Merrick Garland, largely recounted previously exposed flaws in the inquiry while concluding that the FBI suffered from confirmation bias and a lack of analytical rigor as it pursued leads about Mr. Trump's ties to Russia. An objective and honest assessment of these strands of information should have caused the FBI to question not only the predication for Crossfire Hurricane, but also to reflect on whether the FBI was being manipulated for political or other purposes, Durham wrote. Unfortunately, it did not. Durham said he was not recommending any wholesale changes to the FBI or to FBI rules for politically sensitive investigations and for national security wiretaps, which have already been tightened in recent years. Rosemary, you want first?
Sure. Big waste of time and money, sum it up that way. $6.6 million, zero convictions, absolutely no new information about some real faults in the FBI, but those were discovered at the end of 2019 when an inspector general came to the same conclusions about lack of rigor and lack of skepticism when they were looking at reports. It also is an exceedingly misleading document that indicates, the FBI should not have gone after that investigation because because of the Steele dossier. It says explicitly in the report, I looked this up, that that was not the source of the cause of the investigation. That was with a tip from a high-level official that absolutely was handled in the right way. And yet, despite that, Merrick Garland let the report go untouched, unedited, uncommented upon, unlike Bill Barr, who set this investigation up and ruined the Mueller report and was completely a horrible, unethical. It was just awful. And on top of all this, it does not address many of the issues that the New York Times brought up in a big investigation last year about unethical practices of the prosecutors involved in this case. They tried to get information in ways that were unethical, illegal possibly, didn't bring that up at all, just left it all out. So this was a huge waste of time and money. This is why Democrats should never fear when Republicans say, oh, we're going to go investigate you. Comer from Kentucky has had zero results in going after the Biden family. They're now painting him as some sort of big crime figure with crime family, right, with billions of dollars coming in from foreign countries, yet have not produced any evidence, not a single document. They promised a whole bunch of informants. Now suddenly the informants are lost. It is all a shell. And that's why the Biden administration is absolutely correct to just sit back and let them play themselves out. Go have fun, boys, because you're not showing anything.
Jim? Jim,
I was going to say easy to follow up.
Actually, the part that I found interesting was where there's a small section of it, and I haven't read it. I read a summary, but where they say it wasn't treated rigorously, that they didn't follow up on Hillary Clinton appropriately the way they did with Trump. And so I'm sitting there going like, now wait a minute, you know, it's like. The announcements right before the election, the ridiculousness of the FBI investigation at all, the probably cost the election, and they're sitting there going like, and the FBI was not serious like they were in that case. I mean, come on.
Mike?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, there was credible evidence that the Russians were interfering with the 2016 election, that they were trying to help Trump hurt Hillary. And if that's not a reason to commit FBI resources to chase it down, I don't know what is. It was a legitimate reason to go after the absolutely valid evidence that was there. And the Mueller report documented all that.
You want to remind everybody why this was happening?
Well, I mean, it became apparent even before Election Day that Russian entities supported by the Kremlin were, I should look at my tech folks, but they were basically using bots and social media to kind of flood Americans' Facebook pages and other places with pro-Trump, anti-Hillary rhetoric.
Why did they want Trump?
Well, they didn't want Hillary. Trump and Biden were very friendly. Trump is very favorable to Russia, and it certainly and the other, you know, tactic that Russia uses all over Europe and all over the free world is they want to help create chaos, which they've done quite well. So these were all terrible things that were going on. They should have been investigated. If they were not rigorous enough about some of the evidence that it, you know, that it was leading a different way. I'm sorry. This does not change the fact that the Russians were trying to change the outcome of the 2016 election, and that's wrong. And we need to hold them accountable and make sure that Americans know that.
Well, you know, for years I have raised on this panel and to the great rejection of y'all. The idea of national character. And the question is, do the Russians and their politics have a national character that is predictable in terms of dissonance?
Well, I want to say something about what Mike said, because the Russians during the election did something that was even smarter. And by the way, something that every single or almost every single commercial company does, which is try to figure out who is your audience and target them as precisely as possible. And so what the Russians did is they used all of this data that they had gotten in an inappropriate way. It was supposed to be used for research. They used it for this kind of marketing. It was the whole Cambridge Analytica thing. And what they did is they tried to decide which voters they might be able to persuade. And they targeted those voters with messages. So they did the smart thing. But by the way, the last time you bought a baby monitor or like ironclad cookware or, you know, an air conditioner, you know, they're doing the same thing.
Yep.
Anything you see on Amazon, they're probably doing the same thing. So this is, you know, what is known these days about as savvy marketing. And so they savvily, is that a word?
No.
Marketed,
it is now.
You know, the U.S. voting public to try to skew the election. Skewing an election is not a good thing. Is it okay to skew a customer base to want your product? I don't know. So some sense, this is a much bigger issue.
Is that skewing or marketing?
Well, it's marketing, too, and you're right. I mean, in the sense that they try to skew the election by marketing to the most likely voters.
Right.
Yes.
But everyone should be doing that, speaking to your base.
Well, this is not
everybody
them
does do
speaking
that.
To
Since
their
the
base.
JFK
this is a foreign
election.
Country speaking to Trump's base.
Right. Okay,
you know,
so.
No, I understand.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. So if Russia wanted to buy a TV commercial to put on for any candidate, at the bottom, it would say this, you know, this ad was sponsored by, and if you saw this ad was sponsored by the Kremlin, KGB, you know, elect Trump campaign, you might think maybe twice about it, right? Social media, there's no rules about that kind of keeping track. Provenance is the technical term. So there's nothing that says they have to tell you this ad was bought by this company or this Russian guy. You don't get the "my name is Joe Smith and I endorse this."
But commercial. But even the even when you do get the name, you know, all
yeah,
of these packs obscure themselves. You know, it's
oh,
like
true. Right.
You
but,
know,
but,
people
you know,
for a better
least,
America. Oh, by the way, that's Putin and friends. So
yeah, but see, but we would get someone like Rosemary to go out there and start an
investigation. Yeah, Rosemary's going to do it.
She
yeah.
would trace
I'll
it down
care.
And she would say, "Hey,
that.
It turns out
it
that."
Works.
I guess, Rosemary, to what you were talking about of this being, you know, waste of time and money. So once you have a report like this, Merrick Garland doesn't add anything. And what happens?
Put it on a shelf, forget about it, move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
But it becomes, again, it becomes another counter message. You know, it's an alternative that the right can use when someone talks about Mueller report or talks about Russian.
I told you it was a hoax.
Yeah, I mean, all it has to be is an alternative point of view that they can point to.
Well,
and that's good enough for people. They don't have to understand any of it. Oh, okay, okay.
You know, and should
but
Merrick
Mike
Garland
and,
have done something
no.
different?
No, I love that Merrick Garland right. just sent it in.
No redaction.
Problems at all.
Okay.
Because
but,
it's such a contrast to Barr and the Mueller report. Mm-hmm. And you're right, you know, that it'll be used in a way that it definitely does not, it was not intended, does not say. It will be used incorrectly by
incorrectly.
Republicans.
Oh, but it's yeah. even being yeah. used, it's already being used on some of the really right-wing media, which means you'll soon see it in the sort of mainstream right-wing media, to say, see, this is why the lawsuit with the sexual abuse, this is what, you know, they're saying.
Right.
So in other words, one thing shows up as being maybe not have done right. Therefore, everything is wrong. It's all lies.
Right.
And
yes.
I mean,
it is maddening, but that's just propaganda. It has nothing to do with the report and the history
exactly.
that
exactly.
will be supported by the real report.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Comer is to me is much worse. The guy who's coming out with a press conference is saying the whole Biden family is a criminal conspiracy and they're making millions, and he doesn't have one iota of evidence.
Right. Well, he suggests that the Biden family, by instead of saying Hunter Biden made money while Joe Biden was not in the White House, by the way, but because
correct.
Hunter Biden made money during that period, it goes to the Biden family, suggesting that they're kind of giving it to Biden, you know, and he's
right.
enriching himself.
So like if Hunter throws in for a pizza.
Right.
Obviously,
yeah.
you're paying
yeah.
off his dad.
And one of our listeners who debates these issues with me keeps saying, well, come on, Rosemary. If you're hearing he's getting hundreds of millions and it's going to the children, you don't think the father's involved in it or knows about it? And I go, okay, name one other family that does that. So I said, okay, the Kardashians, Trump, the Kennedys, all rich families do this.
Well, yeah,
and it may be illegal, but there's no law against it. Maybe it ought to be.
So here's the question. If one of your children, okay, these are not my children, end up being a serial killer, like, can you not run for president, really, legitimately? I mean, really, how responsible are you for family members? How responsible are you?
Well, it reflects on you. I mean, whether you're maybe the cause of something or what your role was in the behavior of your children, you know, and it still reflects on people.
I mean, Jimmy Carter had trouble with Billy because he was an
Clinton
alcoholic.
Clinton had trouble with his idiot brother. However, my
Roger
views
Clinton,
on this have changed after Ginny Thomas and Clarence. Yes. Now I'm thinking, no, maybe there better be a stronger connection than we've made.
Yeah,
and one does have a connection to the other. And I think it's legitimate in Hunter Biden to investigate his. I think his dealings are completely shady. And if the father was involved, that's legit, too. But they haven't proved anything yet.
Right. But Comer also, by invoking the family, suggesting, you know, something that's not really there, he also says it in the present tense. And it was in the past tense that they're looking at.
Good point.
Quite a ways back. But it's rhetoric, and it's very effective rhetoric that lets people listen to a little of it and say, yeah, you know. And then move on. They don't. You know, it's the counter message.
All right, we have letters, so let's go to those. We welcome yours, panel at WAMC.org.
Do you have a letter from Hunter Biden?
Not yet.
Okay.
I got to check the laptop. It was always about Ukraine, right, Susan? Trump hated NATO and almost killed it. Putin knew that. He would have preferred 8 years of weakening NATO, but he only got four. As soon as Trump was out, he had to act soon to invade Ukraine before NATO got its strength back.
Huh.
Well, that backfired on him because NATO's stronger than ever, bigger than ever.
Larger. Yeah, I mean, they've gained members.
This letter from Paul. The Mueller investigation pointed out that, one, Trump's campaign chairman was meeting regularly with a Russian spy and giving him their inside campaign research and strategy.
Yep.
Two,
that's true.
The Trump campaign knew that the Russians had hacked the Democratic National Committee before that was publicly known. And three, candidate Trump was retweeting Russian propaganda. All of these, though not illegal, warranted concern and an investigation.
Correct. Nice letter, Paul.
Yes, very nice, Paul. We go to Frank. This is why most of the American people don't trust the mainstream media, because you people
uh-oh,
are all hypocrites. by the way, I would just like to say that only four out of the six would be media, and the other two are scientists.
But we're all
real
smart.
Real hypocrites.
And we're right and you're wrong.
We can still be all hypocrites.
Okay. What are we hypocritical
this
about?
This had nothing to do with Donald Trump, but you can admit it it was Hillary Clinton, and it was bought and paid for by her.
Wait a minute.
Are we talking about the Steele dossier?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I just say, I apologize for saying this, I turned completely off at the term you people. This makes me crazy when someone says all X are horrible. You know, it's like if there's more than two people in X, you cannot say that. And I hate this term you people. In fact, Rosemary, you and
I do it
got
all the time.
Fight,
I know we got into a fight over this last time. Yeah,
I
do that as a
generalization. I just think you cannot stamp everyone with a giant broad brush. You can't do it.
Well, I think you can. I think you can. And the comment here is that the media is doing a bad job. That's what I'm interpreting the letter to say that. And there is something to the fact. I mean, the liberals hated the FBI all during the 60s and 70s. I mean, the FBI does not warrant our unjustified allegiance and faith. It was if he had come up with something.
J. Edgar Hoover.
Right. If Durham had come out with something that said the FBI did this or systematically doing that, then I would be leading the charge here to say this is serious and we have to do something about it. But what you have here is this almost $7 million hoax. This really was a witch hunt. And they found zip. And that's why it's so amazing.
Rosemary Armeo on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, May 16th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. We'll be right back. Welcome to the final segment of this week's roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, May 17th, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue were joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
Negotiators yesterday say they're seeing progress on the debt ceiling. And now, who's upset? Well, Biden's liberal allies. Those are the people who are worrying at the moment. This is a roulette wheel of worry, often, of who is upset and mad at any given moment. But in this case, President Biden and top congressional leaders expressed optimism about urgent negotiations over the debt ceiling after a meeting at the White House on Tuesday, as the administration's liberal allies worried that the talks with House Republicans over the budget risk rewarding the GOP's hardline stance. House Republican Kevin McCarthy sounded confident that an agreement could be reached ahead of a June 1st deadline to raise the nation's borrowing limit or risk a global economic catastrophe. That's 2.5 weeks away, by the way. Biden gave a similar assessment, though major differences remain between the two sides before a real deal can be struck. White House officials also announced that Biden will be cutting short a visit to Asia as the administration seeks to finalize an agreement. Aides to McCarthy and Biden will negotiate directly, according to lawmakers. Slimming down the number of parties involved in the talks as the deadline nears, the White House said staff would continue meeting daily, adding that Biden will check in with leaders by phone during his trip this week and in person when he returns. Mark Whitman.
Actually, Joe, I take some comfort in the situation that you described. The fact that the negotiating parties have been slimmed down tells you that they're making progress and getting real. The fact that Biden's coming back, I think, is a good sign. I know we were just talking in the lead up to getting on air. Some others have expressed concern about that. I'll let them do that themselves. I thought about, gee, it's too bad he's got to go back out to Australia, but domestic priorities should be his priority. The fact that our real budget negotiations now tend to happen around this default threat is unfortunate, but if that's what we're doing politically, I think that's most important. And if the president believes that Australia is worth a trip, as I believe he should, because of the importance of it as a counterbalance to China and Asia Pacific, he'll have to make another visit. In the article that you read, there was some hewing and crying from the left flank, as it was called, about the prospect of work requirements attached to government programs. I understand the sensitivity around that. I must also say, and here comes the surly mood, when the best quote the Washington Post can find is from Elizabeth Warren complaining, you're probably doing the right thing, in my mind. I just sometimes her overreactions to these issues are a bit much. If you look back, the last time that in the 2006 era where we put work requirements on welfare, it actually worked out as a general proposition for the country. Now, it was during strong economic times, so there was a tailwind, but we've got that now. That is not to, so I think some of this sort of theoretical concern is overblown if you look at history. Those requirements brought the number of welfare families, the caseload down from 5 million to 2 million. It brought up the employment rate amongst those on welfare and brought up their incomes. Now, when you do something like that, you've got to be careful, right? You have to protect particularly children who are part of families where the adults are sort of mildly disabled, emotionally disturbed, or on drugs. You've got to put in a platform for that. You have to make sure that you continue to uplift the wages and earning potential of the working poor. And you've got to continue to put programs in place that entice particularly young men and young women to stay in school before they start to form families, or once they form families, to still stay in school. So you can't do these things sort of unsympathetically, but the fact that we're looking to do them, I think the left's initial reaction, I think, is overblown.
Bob.
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot to unpack, but it does sound like there is sort of the typical movement towards, and I say typical because this sort of game of chicken that we've been talking about literally for months now about the debt limit. I do think, and I do want to go back to the question, Teresa, that you raised and Mark that you just raised about some of the international aspects of cutting the trip short. However, the domestic and the debt limit, I think, is a big enough priority. I wonder, though, as the, you know, in typical times, you say the negotiations, as they shrink, that means that it's getting closer, that the deal is getting, that's coming due. I just wonder if that still holds true with this current Congress, given how fractious it's been, and whether whether McCarthy's going to really be able to whip enough votes if it's a close issue. So I think that plays another interesting interesting role in it. You know, one of the takeaways that I was thinking about, if, as Mark you pointed out, if the debt limit now becomes a second bite at parties' ability to who have lost a party position or policy position because of budgets and votes, it gives them an ability to go back and undo some of that, then I think the Democrats need to start to embrace that, and that they're going to have to think about how to play chicken with the debt limits as well as the Republicans have. They passed three clean debt limit votes under the Trump administration, and I look at what's being put on the table right now, and I think, well, at its face, if you put safeguards in on things like work requirements, okay, I understand how that would play. My concern is, though, is that we've seen a party that has been unwilling to put safeguard limits on a lot of the policy positions that they've taken. So I do wonder where the line is there. And with a much smaller group, when they come out with an announced package, it's kind of baked. And then the question becomes a yes or no vote. And it's going to be interesting to see how that is actually pushed through. Couple quick comments, and then I'll turn it over to Teresa and Alan. The president needs to prioritize getting back to both Australia and to Papua New Guinea and meet with some of the leaders that that we are not going to be meeting with right now. Anything that we can do to help with to counterbalance the expansion of Chinese influence into those both territorial areas and waters is critically important. And we sent a very bad message. I saw a couple of very interesting articles about, well, this is typical U.S. policy, that we just aren't important. And the time is coming where we're going to need every ally that we can get, and especially in that neck of the woods. So understand why the president's coming back. I just hope that they will turn that plane around relatively quickly, and he will go back and do some damage control, and we can continue to try to deal with the other major concerns, and that includes our own safety and security.
Teresa Bourgeois.
I think that the potential damage that McCarthy and his group are doing to our country domestically and globally is deeply concerning to me. I think we have to step back, big picture, and just remind ourselves that this is not regular order. I mean, the way the budget should be developed is with a lot of back and forth, but through the budget committees, through the House committee process, through the Senate committee process. That's how you air out all these issues. You end up with something, ultimately a compromise. In the end, the last bits are jammed through, but it has gone through a subcommittee and a full committee review process on both sides, and everybody has to work together, and the numbers get shaken out, and that's typically how it happens. Now, you have a problem with McCarthy in that he knows he can't put a real budget proposal on the table because his conference is so divided that he couldn't bring them together. He couldn't put something on the table. And so what he has done to try to deal with his internal
power structure problem or lack of continuity within his own conference. But because he couldn't figure that out, he is roiling the global markets. It's resulted in disrupting some very important meetings that were supposed to happen over the next 2 weeks. This is just a really dangerous precedent and process problem. The big picture of, yes, you need to have these budget fights, but you shouldn't be happy that it's ending up with two people in a room. I mean, that's what he really wants, because he wants to bypass the fact that he can't figure out in his own house and do it the right way. Separately, what you're looking at, this problem that we have, the June 1st problem, could be solved in a minute if you just let the House use the discharge petition. I know, terribly arcane, but it allows them to pull a proposal out of the committee and onto the floor, and you have Democrats vote for it and some group of Republicans and let McCarthy look the other way. And then you could get it through the House, and then it would quickly go through the Senate. You would pass it. You know, retirees won't lose money on the, deep dive in the markets that will inevitably happen, and their savings are going to be hurt, and businesses won't be hurt, and whatever. You could do that. And then you could move on to this very, rancorous budget debate, doing it in the regular process. But no, that's not where we're going. I think McCarthy's change in tone, I don't know for sure, but my guess is that business letter, how many people, leading business people from all over the country signed a letter and said, this is dangerous, get it done. And my guess is change in tone, because what he was saying wasn't much different. We're not close together, but what shifted is him saying, I think we could get something done. But if you look at the substance, he wants to negotiate the budget outside the budget process, McCarthy, and what they passed. And the way he got it passed was by saying to his members, don't worry, this is never going to get signed into law. So then they held their nose and passed it. But one of the things he wants to do is cap the budget increases at 1%, but no details on how he's going to do that. That math doesn't work. That means either 1% across the board, or if you take defense out, which they're going to do, and you take entitlements out, which they'll probably do, that means 50, 51, 52% cuts in all EPA, education, health and human services. How does that math work?
What McCarthy and the Republicans proffered was not a budget. It was a list of hostage demands. It might as well have been from little cutout pieces of newspaper, letter by letter, like a hostage letter, because that's all it was. It wasn't a
coherent. I don't know that it wasn't.
It wasn't. Yeah, it might have been. It would have been appropriate. So let me just back up half a step. The best chance to avoid this was during the lame duck session. President, I know the Congress, Biden, failed, and the Republicans are irresponsible. We should not be playing on this ledge, but we are, so we need to come up with a compromise and get off the ledge. If you look at historically, the stock market falls about 6.5% in the weeks leading up to one of these imbroglios. I think the cost to Americans in terms of the degradation of the faith and credit of the American financial system is even greater.
Right.
And I think it's permanent, at least until the market forgets it, which may be a long time if we keep doing this on an ongoing basis. And that's not to say there's going to be another world currency. It's just going to say that the degree of our preeminence and the efficiency with which we borrow will decrease. It will become more expensive if we keep playing these stunts. But on to the specifics, the Republican list of demands to get the hostage back was an initial list, and it looks like they're paring it down. And this is the wrong context. But this country needs to get its fiscal house in order. If I may, I believe it was Fried Zakaria who said, and he probably was quoting somebody else, so I should be careful. But he said, Americans love Democratic spending and Republican taxation. The problem is we can't get a budget that meets in the middle of those two, and we as a country need to work it out. Unfortunately, this is where we've decided to have the fight, but so be it. Let's start getting our fiscal house in order.
But the history, if you look at the historic charts of who has exploded the debt and who has contained it, it's the Democrats who've contained it and the Republicans have exploded the debt because they focus on these tax breaks that don't benefit average Americans, right?
I agree entirely.
Historically, and what Biden has done in spite of having, still dealing with the COVID problem, has, he has brought down the deficits, right? They've started to come down. If you look at the charts, they're coming down. Now, they're not coming down as fast as they need to, but they are coming down. But even look at one of the proposals in here is, quote unquote, claw back the unspent COVID relief money. Oh, that sounds great, right? There's whatever, $70 billion in unspent. Well, actually go look at the details of that. A, that's already baked in the numbers of the economists. I've read it in four or five different places, so they were already planning on that. And B, that's money, it's not been spent yet, but it's intended to be spent for all sorts of reasons that the country needs. So, for instance, you know, I know firsthand experience, our senior center, you need to improve the air ventilation system so that if this ever happens again. Didn't get the money in the first round, maybe you'd get the money in the second round. Should that be clawed back? This money was to be spent over 10 years, was intentional, and clawing it back is not going to have the intended purpose of affecting the debt limit numbers at all, because it was already calculated in. The rescind key programs in the Inflation Reduction Act. Well, they couldn't stop it in the beginning, and so they're trying to stop it now. That's not, you know, the key climate change infrastructure, right? These are policy things that they want to dismantle the Biden agenda. Biden, despite what everybody says, he's had an incredibly successful legislative agenda, yet they want to dismantle it.
And I think this is what bothers me about, by having this type of discussion, you called it hostage taking, you were talking about policy, it's really giving McCarthy almost a line item veto to be able to go back in and identify things that had been negotiated as part of the compromise in the budget process or as part of the policy documentation to target things that they don't like. That's exactly what's happening right now, which is part of my heartburn, is that this is not the way it's supposed to go. I get the fact that we're dancing on the ledge and dance, but this also goes back to my other comment that in the future, I don't think that Democrats can just do a clean bill the way they have in the past. If this is the way you make substantive policy corrections or pivots, then they're going to have to use this tool, which means that this is going to be more and more an important part of policy considerations. In some respects, maybe even more so important than the budget considerations, because it's easier to pinpoint what you don't like. And think about just the terminology that we're using, because if you're just sort of sitting back thinking, I don't really follow a lot of this, but clawback. Oh, that sounds good. That sounds like we're getting our money back from people who are abusing it. The idea that once again we're pushing the welfare cheat out there and we're pushing people on welfare to have to go work, that, you know, in the back of your mind it's like, well, it's because those people are stealing our money. I mean, there's a number of tropes that have worked really, really well for the Republicans for, frankly, generations now, back to Reagan and earlier, that are linked with this.
And they piled them in here, put a bow on it, and said that they're doing great things. But if you look at the substance, look at the substance of the work requirement. It costs more to do it than it does to implement it. And the other half of the data that you didn't talk about is the rapid rise in poverty. But there's a provision in there about regulatory authority that says if you pass a regulation, then it goes into the agency, EPA, whoever, and then they decide how it's going to be implemented. Well, now a provision in there says, well, then you have to go back to the Congress and have a vote on whether or not they propose to implement it properly. That just stops it.
It's actually three people in the room. It's McConnell, it's McCarthy, and it's Biden, which I found it really interesting that Schumer and Jeffries were not part of that. And I just, you know, just toss that out as a conversation piece.
So let's talk about, first of all, Teresa, I understand that the initial list of hostage demands had in it some very unreasonable components, including what you mentioned around change and presumption around regulation, that my expectation is that that won't be in what's final, that they're not going to get that list. They're going to get some elements of that list. So unless and until we know that's imminent, let's leave that. Let's agree that it's a bad thing. And let's talk about some of the things that look more likely to survive. The clawback, as I understand it, are funds that are not yet committed. Everybody agrees we overspent during COVID. So the fact that as a general proposition, we're thinking about taking some of that money off the table doesn't, I'm sure there are always examples of where, gee, we probably should spend the extra money here. But as a general proposition, it doesn't sound unreasonable. And let's talk about the Inflation Reduction Act. Right. Some panelists in this room on the day it was passed, said the problem with these things is they get far more expensive on the spending side and far less effective on the taxing side. Well, guess what's happened? Initially, the government had an estimate of $400 billion for subsidies for purchases of electric vehicles. That subsidy, because it was uncapped and because of the new set of projections, is now estimated to be over $1.1 trillion. So the fact that Republicans or anyone are raising their hand and saying, wait a second, we thought we were passing something that was about $400 billion, and now it's multiples of that, I think it's entirely it shouldn't be under these circumstances, but as long as we're going to have a fight about revenue and spending, let's have a discussion about something like that.
But the key thing you just said was it shouldn't be under these circumstances. These kinds of policy questions have to be discussed, but they have to be discussed with everybody, including, you know, Senator Schumer, including the House Democrats. This is not that process. I know it sounds ridiculously wonky, but this is not the place to do that. And when you do, then you create this uncertainty in the U.S. markets and in the global markets. Businesses, you know better than I, they shift what their plans are because they have to anticipate what if these folks do go over the edge, right? They have to be prepared for that. You're going into a G7 meeting and with a weak hand because these countries now have to say, you know, are you going to destabilize our economies by not doing this, right? It changes the dynamic in extremely dangerous and long-term costly way. It's reckless.
And back to Bob's point, Bob said, I think the Democrats should start taking hostages. What I would propose, the Democrats, next time they're in hostage-taking mood, should say, hey, look, maybe it's 5 years from now or 10 years from now, we're going to take the debt ceiling out of the calculation once and forever for both sides.
Perfect.
That's a better proposal.
That's what has to happen. Right. So that's the problem here.
So let's agree we shouldn't be fighting on the ledge. But unfortunately, it's the ledge that the Republicans saw as available to them. The Democrats were unable to take it off the table during the lame duck session, and here we are. Agreeing that the ledge is a bad place to have these fights—
I say the Democrats and Republicans didn't take it off the table. There were responsible Republicans who could have stepped in and helped take it off the table in the lame duck and they did not.
Sure, and
so
I bet
it's not just the Democrats. It's the Democrats and Republicans. McConnell knows better. There's Republicans who know better. They know how dangerous this is to the U.S. and global economy, and they did not act.
Your red light is blinking, Mark. That gives you the green light. Go ahead.
No, I that's a fair point that to say, you know, the Democrats failed to do it. They failed to capitalize on what seemed like an advantage to them, but may not have been given the underlying head counts, and both parties are responsible. That's fair. But I do think when I think, frankly, some on the left do this, when you talk about some of the reasonable things that the Republicans are asking to look at, given the fact that we have a big budget problem in this country, a big one, a generation from now, people are going to look around at the United States, at a country that used to spend about $1.6 for every dollar it took in on an annual basis, and they're going to have to pay the debt down, which may be, if it continues, they may have to actually add a digit to that debt clock in Midtown Manhattan in terms of how bad this is going to get if we don't stop our profligate spending. And that generation is going to say, hey, the government used to pass out $1.03 to $1.05 for every dollar took in. And now I'm only getting 95 cents because we have to pay it down. I mean, there's a whole generation that's going to say, where the heck did the money go? And it's going to be our responsibility. So we need to stop this nonsense now, and we might as well have the fight.
Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 17th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.